So, hello everybody. Today's lecture will be about two topics: energy transfer and electron transfer. So, let me start by sharing the screen. And here we go. And yes, okay. So energy transfer is a process where we initially excite a molecule, and instead of giving up its energy as fluorescence or non-radiative relaxation, it transfers the excitation energy to another molecule. And as we will learn today, it may occur over quite some distance. In this picture shows the principle. So we have an ensemble of molecules. Here is the excited molecule, and molecule can emit radiation, or it can transfer its excitation to a nearby molecule. And this energy transfer phenomenon is common in nature. And for example, on the left here is a concept of energy antenna. And there, the idea is that we have some primary molecules on the left which absorb radiation. And then on the right, we have a reaction center where a reaction occurs which needs the energy of a photon. But it is more favorable to build up this kind of a network of molecules where energy is transferred from molecule to molecule all the way finally to the reaction center where the reaction happens. So this kind of system is operative in photosynthetic reaction centers where several chlorophyll molecules are arranged in such a way that any of them can absorb radiation and transfer their energy via energy transfer phenomenon or mechanism to the reaction center where the actual reaction happens. On the right-hand side, we have an application where energy transfer is used to measure distances. The idea is the following. We have, for example, a protein which has a structure which is not known for us, but we can attach in two different places molecules, two molecules. One of them will be the energy transfer donor, one of them will be acceptor. And when we measure the energy transfer between them, we can determine the distance between them. So this gives structural information on the protein. So this energy transfer effect has many useful applications. There are different energy transfer mechanisms. The first one is a so-called radiative or trivial mechanism, which is kind of a very simple mechanism. There we start with excited molecule marked by a star, and it relaxes to the ground state and gives a photon away. This photon then is used to create absorption mechanism in another mo molecule. So it is a sequential emission absorption phenomenon. And in principle, energy has been transferred from one molecule to another. And as you can guess, this mechanism is operative over huge distances, not only in nearby molecules and maybe in a solution, but it is operative over basically any distance. If we think of, for example, looking at the stars in the sky, the photons come in our eyes and they excite some molecules, retinal molecules in our eyes. And in this way, we can think that the process in a star has resulted in energy transfer to a molecule in our eye. So, of course, this mechanism is very common and extremely long distance. So it's kind of a radiation and absorption sequential mechanism. And although it's quite easily understandable and simple, the mathematical description and modeling is not so easy, so we don't consider this further. But it maybe suffices to say that what are the important factors for this kind of energy transfer? Certainly the emission quantum yield of the donor. If the quantum yield is large, then the energy transfer can be also effective. If it's small, it cannot be. And concentration of A, so how much molecules, what is the density of molecules A around D? And overlap of the emission spectrum of the donor and the absorption spectrum of the acceptor. And this we can describe mathematically with this kind of expression, where this J is the overlap integral, and we have integral over emission spectrum of the donor and absorption spectrum described with the molar absorption coefficient of the acceptor. And here we can see in more detail what is meant by this integral, how this works, this integral. So down here we have absorption spectrum of acceptor and emission spectrum of the donor. And certainly, if we have overlap of some of the lines of the spectrum of the emission and the absorption, it is possible to excite molecule, the acceptor, with the emission of the donor. And then this overlap here is the then factor that is proportional to the efficiency of this energy transfer. And here, so we can calculate this overlap integral if we just measure the emission and absorption spectra. And upstairs we see that this overlap region corresponds to transitions where the transition energy of the donor is equal to absorption energy of the acceptor. So we say that they are resonant. They are in resonance. So energy is equal for emission and absorption. And for any energy transfer phenomena, this is important. Now, there is one situation where it is necessary to take into account this effect, and it is when you measure emission spectrum of molecule in the presence of other molecules which may absorb part of the radiation. So then it can happen that your emission spectrum will be modified because some of it will be absorbed by the other molecules. Even this can lead to so-called self-absorption. So as you remember, there can be small overlap between the emission and absorption spectrum of the same molecule. So even the molecule itself can absorb the radiation emitted by the same molecules elsewhere in a solution. Okay, but more interesting for us is radiationless energy transfer. And now we are going to study that. So this mechanism occurs in molecular scale. And now we are going to give us a short descriptive theoretical treatment of this effect. And whenever we have this kind of quantum transitions, we use Fermi's golden rule to describe the transition rate. And we don't have to go into much detail, but we just look at a few important results. So the rate of the process where we have the excited donor and ground state acceptor, and that leads to ground state donor and excited acceptor, can be described with this expression, which is the Fermi golden rule expression, where we have some constants and the density of states. And then this quantity here is the important one. It's the matrix element for interaction which couples initial state and final state. And this is our final state, and this is our initial state. And then we have to have some kind of operator which describes this coupling between these states. And this, we take a square of that. And if we can calculate this, then we can calculate the rate. Okay, so now we consider the states first. And all what I'm showing is it's not really truly rigorous, but it is approximately expressed. So initial state can be considered as a product of excited donor and ground state acceptor wave function. And the final state is a product of ground state donor and excited state acceptor wave function. What about the operator which couples these states together? It turns out that in the operator we have two kinds of terms. The first term is exchange. At this point, we don't have to look exactly how it looks like, but I'm just giving you an idea that this operator describes electron exchange between the different states. So basically, it describes the electron exchange, and we can guess that that requires some kind of overlap with the wave functions. But second term is a Coulombic term. So that is a term which couples initial and final state via Coulombic interactions. So basically, interactions of the charge distributions. Now, if we plug in this operator and these wave functions to this expression and leave out the constants and density of states, we see that the energy transfer rate depends on these two terms. There is something else, but these are important terms. So first one is basically Fermi-Gordan rule type of expression for electron exchange interaction between these states, and the second one is a Coulombic interaction between these two states. So based on this idea, we can already predict that there will be two different kind of mechanisms for energy transfer, Coulombic mechanism and exchange mechanism. And first we describe, we inspect the Coulomb mechanism. So what do we mean by this? This is a kind of a classical idea. And we can think of the excited donor as an oscillating dipole. And this oscillating dipole would induce oscillating dipole in the acceptor if there is any polarizability in this acceptor. And if there is a resonance condition so that the energy of this of frequency of the oscillation matches some frequency of the, some state here in A, there can be energy transfer from donor to the acceptor. So we already see that this means that this oscillating charge distribution induces oscillation, charge distribution oscillation in acceptor. And this is the basic physical mechanism or the idea behind this energy transfer mechanism. Now that's a classical idea. And now we describe this quantum mechanically. And this theory carries the name of a famous physical chemist, Theodor Förster. And we call this Förster theory for energy transfer via Coulombic mechanism. And the great idea of Förster was to consider quantum mechanical theory of Coulombic energy transfer and express the important parameters with experimental quantities. And now let's go briefly through the main ideas of the Förster theory. It starts from classical interaction energy between two dipoles. So it considers dipole-dipole interaction. And this part is still a classical description. If you have two dipoles, their interaction is proportional to this term here, where you have the dipole moment of the donor times dipole moment of the acceptor divided by their distance to the third power. So this is a classical electrostatic theory. Now, what Foerster did was to use this interaction, this dipole-dipole interaction energy as a Coulombic operator term for the Fermi-Gordan rule. And he replaced the classical dipoles by quantum mechanical transition dipoles. So transition dipole of donor and acceptor. And then he calculated the rate using Fermi's Gordan rule. So this is where we get into. We insert this, but now we consider these dipoles as transition dipole of donor and transition dipole of acceptor and take the square. So this is our final expression. It contains the squares of the transition dipoles divided by sixth power of the distance between them, the molecules. Now, we look back to the first lecture and recall that we actually have relation between transition dipole moment and experimental quantities. Integrated absorption coefficient or radiative rate constant. Both are proportional to transition dipole moments. So Foerster's idea was to use these experimental quantities to describe the transition dipole moment. So either integrated molar absorption coefficient or radiative rate constant can be used instead of the transition moment. And, well, it is quite natural to use the radiative rate constant for the donor and integrated molar absorption coefficient for the acceptor. So now the expression is modified. So that instead of the transition moments, we have radiative rate constant and integrated molar absorption coefficient. But still, we have the sixth power of the distance. Now, so this describes the rate, but we still have to have a resonant process. That means we have to have the same energy for the donor emission process or the donor excited state as the acceptor absorption process. And this condition we can take into account by using the spectral overlap, because that basically describes the spectral overlap or resonance condition between acceptor and donor. And when we take that into account, our expression for the rate of energy transfer, rate constant for energy transfer, looks like this. So we have a couple of additional terms now, but we have this still the radiative rate constant, the distance to the sixth power, and now the J, which is spectral overlap. And you can see that now this integrated molar absorption coefficient went somewhere, but it has been absorbed into this spectral overlap integral. I will come to that back soon. Soon again. Yes. Now, but we have a couple of additional factors there, and I will explain them first. First of all, usually this energy transfer process occurs in some kind of solution or some kind of environment, and this environmental effect is taken into account via refractive index. So here we have n to the fourth power, and n here is the refractive index of the medium. And now this kappa squared term is the orientation factor. And orientation factor depends on the orientation, of course, but here we have a couple of special geometries for the orientation of the acceptor and donor and the corresponding factor. So if the orientation is random, then all possible orientations have been averaged, and then the factor will be 2/3. If you have head to tail of the two dipoles, or transition dipole moments, a factor is 2, and if they are parallel, factor is 1. So basically, this factor is a factor which is on the order of 1, but it can go up to 2, and depending on orientation. And of course, if we have molecules in solution, we use this random orientation. If we go into more careful expression or for the factor, the full orientation dependence is given by this equation, which looks very a bit tricky, but it's not. So this factor can be described with the vectors, where we have the vector for the transition dipole moments of A and B, so basically acceptor and donor. And R is the distance vector between them. And so this is expression from which you calculate these other specific orientation factors. And the picture here describes the situation. We have a transition dipole A and transition dipole B and the distance between them. And we can see that if there is a condition where mu A and mu B are orthogonal, so they are at the right angle, this factor will be 0. But that is not sufficient condition for the whole expression to be 0. But if at the same time either A or B is orthogonal to the distance vector, then either one will be 0, and then the whole thing will be 0. And in this case, the energy transfer rate will be 0. So in the special condition, energy transfer will be suppressed. Okay, but generally it is on the order of 1 to 2, or in special circumstances, 0. And now we get back to this overlap integral, and it looks like this. So in this overlap integral, we have, first of all, here the molar absorption coefficient. Now this integral is given in terms of wave number. So molar, this is a spectrum. Molar absorption coefficient as a function of wave number. And then times this F factor, which is given down here, and that is the intensity of emission spectrum. So this is basically ID is an emission spectrum as a function of wave number. But because the emission spectrum intensity is not anything absolute, it depends on experimental factors and measurement geometry and everything. We have to normalize this somehow, and it is normalized by the total integral of the emission spectrum over the whole spectrum. So this is a normalization factor, and that normalizes this emission spectrum. And now this we insert here, and then this factor here has to be included, so it's a wave number to the fourth power, and then if you calculate the whole integral, that gives you the J factor. So this shows you that in order to calculate energy transfer rate, you actually can calculate the absolute rate if you measure the absorption spectrum of the acceptor, the emission spectrum of the donor, and then you assume something about the orientation between them. And this is remarkable because it means that from this spectroscopic data, you can actually calculate the energy transfer rate. And of course, there has been a lot of tests for it, and it turns out that this theory works extremely well. So when you have accurately measured spectra and you calculate the rate, it really very well corresponds to the observed rate. I'm showing you one example. This kind of measurements or systems have been prepared where you have a rigid backbone molecule here, bisteroid, and on both ends a molecule has been attached covalently. Here the donor antracyl donor molecule, and here acceptor naphthol molecule. And because this is completely rigid, The distance between these molecules is fairly accurately known. So in this case, it's about 20 angstroms. And now if you measure the spectra of these acceptor and donor, and you know the distance, you can actually calculate the rate for energy transfer. And if you calculate the distance from the theory, you calculate, you measure the emission, how much emission of the donor is quenched by the acceptor, and from this information, by using first the theory, you calculate the distance, you get 19 angstroms, and if you use a molecular modeling from the structure, you would get 21 angstroms. So basically, the first theory gives you extremely good value for the distance, and that shows that this the theory works extremely well. There are many other examples of testing the first theory, and it works truly well. But I'm showing you one example of this energy first energy transfer from our own work. So this is energy transfer between a gold nanocluster and organic dye. Here is the picture of the system. So this is a molecule we have seen, some of you have seen previously. So this is a 102 gold atom cluster with the paramercaptobenzoic acid ligands. And this kind of organic dye molecule, which we call Ku, has been attached on it. And here is the emission spectrum of the Ku, and here is the absorption spectrum of the gold cluster. And we can see that there is definitely a good overlap integral between them in this range. And that means that there should be a efficient energy transfer from the organic dye molecule to the cluster. And here is emission data from the Ku dye. And this blue one shows the emission spectrum at pH 4.1. It turns out for this system that the complexation equilibrium between the dye and the cluster depends on pH. And at pH 4.1, they detach. So there's the equilibrium is towards the separated species. And then we get emission from the free Ku dye, sorry. But if you go to high pH, like 10, you get very little emission, which means that emission is quenched because of energy transfer to the cluster. And from here, you know that at high pH, they are complex. So the equilibrium is strongly on the complex side. And this immediately shows that this kind of system can be used as a pH sensor, optical pH sensor. So now, as the complexation depends on pH, and when they are complexed, the fluorescence is strongly quenched because of the energy transfer, then this forms an optical pH sensor. Now we did first their energy transfer calculations, and they explain the observations. Here we have a logarithmic scale of energy transfer rate, and here is a logarithmic scale for fluorescence quantum yield, and the distance between the cluster and the dye molecule. And here with the dashed line is roughly the equilibrium distance between them. And you can see that the energy transfer rate is very high, more than 10 to 12 per second. And the fluorescence quantum yield is very, very small. You see the less than 10 to minus 5. So this is fully quenched. And then when the distance goes up, the energy transfer rate decreases and the fluorescence quantum yield increases. And we can see that we have to go something like 7-8 nanometers until the fluorescence quantum yield becomes more than 10%. So here, up to this distance, more than 7 nanometers, we start to get strong fluorescence. And from the really equilibrium complex distance, it's fully quenched, and in between something else. So this shows that this energy transfer works over several nanometers. And And therefore, we can probe distances in this scale by observing this energy transfer. And how you observe the energy transfer is by observing the quenching of fluorescence. Now, this can be used as an intracellular pH sensor, as shown here. So we basically prepare this kind of hybrid between the diamolecule and the cluster, and they can be taken into a cell, and inside the cell, they go into endosomes, and basically this swallows, the cell swallows these hybrids and encapsulates them in micelles, and these micelles start to move in within the cell, and when it moves, they acidify, and when they acidify, this bond is broken, and they form this complex equilibrium, which reports then on this acidity of the endosome via observing fluorescence from the diamolecule. So we have used this for bioimaging. Okay, so this was about the Foerster mechanism or Coulomb mechanism of energy transfer. And now, so this is very common mechanism occurring in fluorescent systems. Now we take a look into the electron exchange mechanism. This is called Dexter's theory or electron exchange mechanism. And that really is mechanism where acceptor and donor exchange electrons. And that requires some kind of overlap between the electronic wave functions, which means that this is a very short distance energy transfer. Now, this is the expression for energy transfer via exchange mechanism is given by this expression. We have K factor and we have J factor, which is again this spectral overlap integral. And then we have exponentially decaying factor where we have the distance between acceptor and donor here. And this is a van der Waals distance. So basically, it depends exponentially on the distance, which is stronger than the sixth potential of distance in the Coulomb mechanism. Okay, so now this K factor is something which is difficult to calculate, so that depends on specific orbital interactions. So in order to calculate this, we need some kind of quantum mechanical model for your molecules. Now this is J is again spectral overlap integral, and that is normalized again according to the emission intensity, but it is also normalized according to the absorption coefficient of the acceptor. So that means that value doesn't depend on a molar absorption coefficient, just overlap, so basically resonant condition. And then we have this distance R, and that is compared to the van der Waals distance L. So when they are at equilibrium van der Waals distance, that is L, and then that goes here. Okay, so this shows that the spectral overlap integral is otherwise the same as in the previous case, but in addition to the normalization of the emission spectrum, we also normalize with respect to the absorption. Molar absorption coefficient. So that means that this is only describes the overlap or the resonance conditions, but doesn't depend on molar absorption coefficient. Okay, so now we can compare. So Foerster and Dexter mechanism. Foerster, it is long range because it dies as inverse sixth power of distance. And Dexter is short range, it dies exponentially with distance. Now, Foerster mechanism, it depends on oscillator strength of both donor emission and acceptor absorption transitions, but the Dexter mechanism does not depend on oscillator strengths. Foerster mechanism depends mainly on oscillator strength of acceptor transition, but Dexter does not depend directly on any measurable quantity. And both depend on spectral overlap integral because that is the resonance condition, so that there are states, energy states, which are isoenergetic for donor and acceptor. Good. So now we have these two mechanisms and we go through four different cases and discuss a little bit them. The first case is so-called singlet-singlet energy transfer. And now, what do we mean by that? We mean this. The donor is an excited singlet state. Acceptor is first on the ground singlet state. And after energy transfer, the donor is on the ground singlet state and acceptor is at the excited singlet state. Now, we can see that if we inspect the donor process itself, donor goes from singlet to singlet. That is a loud transition. And acceptor goes from singlet to singlet. That is also a loud transition. And if we look this overall, the left side is a singlet plus singlet, so it's a singlet. The right-hand side is singlet, singlet, so it's a singlet. So this is fully allowed, spectroscopically allowed mechanism. And the first term mechanism is operative. It works. Dexter mechanism is also allowed. There is nothing that would forbid it. And now, to know which mechanism works, it's not straightforward. So usually one has to perform perhaps several experiments to probe that. And sometimes both mechanisms can be active at the same time. But there are a couple of things that you can look into. For example, if you prepare a solution where your donor acceptor molecules are diffusing, then as we can understand that the Dexter mechanism or exchange requires molecules to really collide so that their wave functions can overlap. It means that in order for this energy transfer to occur, they have to collide, meet in a solution, and then separate from each other. But for the first mechanism, they actually don't have to collide, but this can happen from a close distance, but they don't have to collide. So now we can realize that actually the Dexter mechanism is limited by the diffusion of molecules. And then if the observed energy transfer rate is much larger than diffusion rate of your molecules in a solution, then certainly first-term mechanism must be active or dominant. Or if the energy transfer rate is insensitive to viscosity. So if you change the viscosity of your solvent and it doesn't really depend on that, then you can deduce that this is probably a Coulombic mechanism. But if your energy transfer rate is approximately the same as the diffusion mechanism, diffusion rate, and the energy transfer rate is sensitive to viscosity, then this is a good signature that exchange mechanism may be dominant. Now, we have to remember that situation is usually not zero or one, but both can be operative. Of course, if your acceptor molecule has a very low molar absorption coefficient, first-term mechanism becomes slow, and then probably exchange mechanism is dominant. And vice versa, if you have very high molar absorption coefficient for acceptor, then this would favor the Coulombic mechanism. So basically, both mechanisms can take place, and in order to know which one or which one is dominant, you need perhaps a few clever experiments to define that. Now, the next mechanism is so-called triplet-triplet energy transfer. And what do you mean by this? Is that the donor is now the triplet state. An acceptor is first on the ground singlet state. And after the energy transfer, donor goes to singlet state and the acceptor goes to the triplet state. Now we can see that if I inspect the donor itself, the donor goes from triplet to singlet. So that is a forbidden transition. An acceptor goes from singlet to triplet. That is also forbidden. So basically, that means that all the radiative rate constant and molar absorption coefficient will be very, very small. So we can say that Coulombic mechanism must be forbidden. But if we look at the overall process, the left-hand side is a singlet plus triplet, and the right-hand side is a singlet plus triplet. So overall, this whole thing is allowed, which means that the exchange mechanism is allowed. And this triplet-triplet energy transfer occurs presumably via a Dexter or exchange mechanism. And in fact, this energy transfer mechanism is very important and common because this triplet state has a very long lifetime usually. So once we prepare the triplet state, it lives for a very long time in a solution, and it can encounter it multiple times with the acceptor molecules and transfer the energy. So this is very common mechanism. It's most common mechanism in organic photochemistry. Of course, this is related to the oxygen quenching we have already encountered previously. So that is typically this kind of mechanism where the oxygen is acceptor. Okay, then triplet-singlet energy transfer. There, the donor goes from triplet to singlet, and the acceptor from singlet to singlet. Now, again, Coulomb mechanism is spin forbidden because of this donor process. But exchange mechanism is also forbidden because the left-hand side is singlet plus triplet, right-hand side is singlet plus singlet. So both are forbidden. And this is a rare mechanism, which means that the rate constant is small. But there are some examples of this. And especially this long lifetime of the triplet state compensates for the small rate constant, and this is still observable in some cases. But clearly, it is not as common as the previous one. Then finally, we have singlet-triplet energy transfer, where we have, for the donor, we have basically an allowed process, but for the acceptor, we have a forbidden process, an overall forbidden. So both are forbidden, so it's a rare mechanism, and moreover, we have a short-lived singlet state as a donor. So this is very, 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 very rare mechanism. But of course, some examples exist. And here is given the quenching of anthracene derivatives by naphthalene. And you can observe this in a case when singlet-singlet energy transfer, which is a competing mechanism, if that is improbable because of large endotermicity. So then one can maybe observe this mechanism. And if we have a heavy atom effect operative, then this is possible to observe this effect. Okay, so at this point, we stop the energy transfer mechanism and close here and go next to the electron transfer. So in the previous case, we only transfer energy between molecules, and now we discuss the case of electron transfer. And let's start by considering the elementary processes that are involved in electron transfer, and start from a photoionization. And of course, we have already encountered photoionization in XPS. So basically, we eject electron from the bound state to continue. And this we describe with ionization potential or ionization energy. They are the same thing. And we can have multiple processes, first, second, and nth ionization potential corresponding to ionization of the neutral molecule, or 1 plus molecule, 2 plus, and so on. So, of course, one can have sequential several ionization processes, but mostly we are interested in the first one. And in gas phase, typical ionization potentials for molecules are given here. Some common molecules for water, 12.6 electron volts. And here is also given the wavelength of radiation that corresponds to this ionization potential or ionization energy. So we see, as we learned in the UPS, that we need deep UV radiation to ionize molecules. Methane similar to water, but then we go to a bit larger hydrocarbons or aromatic compounds like benzene. We have already much lower, like 9 eV, or naphthalene is 8 eV, and so on. So, but around 10 electron volts. So we anyway need highly energetic radiation to induce the ionization. But the picture changes dramatically when we go to condensed phase, for example, in the solution. Because now we are not ionizing electron into vacuum, but into solution. And for example, if we are in water, now we are talking about this process. We have molecule in aqueous environment, and when we ionize, we get positive ion solvated by water and electron solvated by water. And this solvation energy is very large for both positive ion and the negative ion or electron. And that means that this process occurs at much lower energies. And of course, this solvation is because the water molecules are very polar, so they like to solvate effectively or efficiently the ions. And this species here, the solvated electron, it is a true real species. You can generate it, you can observe it. And of course, it's a very powerful reducing agent. Or now if we have electrons in solution, they don't live very long, so they will be attached to solvent molecules, for example. And here is an example. If we put naphthalene into acetonitrile solution, we can have this kind of process where we ionize the naphthalene and the solvent molecule, acetonitrile, accepts the electron. And we have both positive and negative ions. Now, this is not a stable situation, and eventually they will recombine, and this time scale can be quite fast, so in microseconds, and there is no net reaction in this case. But it's possible to observe transiently these species, for example, via time result spectroscopy. However, if we add something which is called electron scavenger to this solution, then this electron can attach to the scavenger and induce maybe a photochemical reaction. For example, here we had the electron attached on the acetonitrile, and then if we have at the same time bromobenzene, electron can be transferred to this molecule, and what happens is that this bromide ion dissociates and leaves a radical, benzyl radical behind. And this is much more stable situation. So in this case, we would have this kind of photochemical reaction where we first induce the primary photoinduced reaction like this, and then electron attaches to the bromobenzene, cleaves off the bromide ion, and then we generate radicals, benzyl radicals, in the solution. So this is an example of a photochemical reaction. And that leads to irreversible degradation of the molecules. Okay, now that already shows some examples of reactions where we have an electron transferred from one molecule to another. And we can have intramolecular or intermolecular electron transfer, and these are very common and fundamental reactions occurring in nature and in chemical reactions. And for example, photosynthesis is based on this kind of electron transfer reaction. Here is a picture of that. And in fact, it is so that in photosynthesis, we have both energy transfer and electron transfer reactions going on. And this is something that is not so well known anymore. Conventional photography was based on a photochemical reaction. But of course, nowadays, when we have digital cameras, we don't use so much conventional photography anymore. But it was based on the electron transfer, photo-induced electron transfer reaction. Well, now we would like to look into more detail of electron transfer reactions. So we describe it in this way. Again, we have donor and we have acceptor. And this time, the donor gives out the electron to and it gives it to the acceptor. So it is the ion pair, so N plus plus N minus. And this means that you can photoexcite the donor, and from the photoexcited state, you have this kind of electron transfer reaction. And so basically, we have two simultaneous processes occurring. We have oxidation, so the donor is oxidized, and the oxidation can be described with oxidation potential. This is a potential that describes this reaction, how much basically energy is needed to drive this reaction. And it, of course, depends on the solvent. Then we have reduction, and the reduction is also described with reduction potential. So basically, it's an oxidation reduction reaction, which occurs due to photoexcitation. Now, of course, this electron transfer can occur without photoexcitation, but photoexcitation leads to a situation where electron transfer is much more favorable than for ground state molecules. And this picture explains why it is so. So looking on the left side, we have an orbital diagram. And if we think what happens in reduction, we start from the left-hand side. So this is a ground state molecule where we have two electrons on a homo orbital, no electrons on the luma orbital. And we have electron in the vacuum, so basically it's separated. And if this electron attaches to the molecule, leading to reduction, it has to go to the luma orbital. And the energy gain from the vacuum to luma orbital is equal to electron affinity. And that is the difference between the vacuum level and the luma level. So this much energy is gained when the molecule accepts electron, becomes negatively charged. And that is kind of giving driving force for the reaction to occur. But if we have excited state molecule, we have excited electron already here on the luma orbital. And now we see that we generate a hole on the homo orbital. That means that electron now can go to homo orbital. And this is much larger energy. So the electron affinity of the excited state molecule is much higher than electron affinity of the ground state molecule. So that means that there is a much larger driving force for reduction for the excited state species. What about oxidation? Let's inspect that. So again, on the left, we have ground state molecule. And in order to ionize, we have to excite electron from the homo orbital to the vacuum. And it requires this much energy. But what about if we start from excited state, where we have already electron on luma orbital? Now the ionization requires only this much energy, because we can ionize from the luma orbital. So the oxidation is much more favorable for excited state molecules. So both reduction and oxidation are more favorable for excited state molecules. And that's why this photo-induced electron transfer is something fairly common. Okay, so what happens? What should we take into account when we consider electron transfer? Now, let's look down here. This is now the system which very clearly describes the needed changes, because we have a same molecule R, same species R in the starting point, but one of them is positive ion, so R plus, and then we have neutral R. So this is our initial situation, and the final state is where electron has been transferred from the neutral R to R plus, yielding neutral R and R plus. So the initial state and final state are equivalent, but just different molecules now change the character. So in the initial state, we have solvent molecules that are oriented around the positive ion, and they are at equilibrium. And you can guess if we have polar solvent, there's a very strong solvation of molecules, and they are also solvating the neutral molecule. But in the end state, we have opposite situation. So we can see that it requires a lot of solvent reorganization in order to reach this state from the initial state. And because we remember that when the electron jumps, it is extremely fast motion where the nuclei don't have time to move. And that's why we can consider that the electron jump requires energy. So we have to go to some high energy state because the solvent is not organized properly for the end state. So that means that we follow this kind of a route where we need to go from this state to final state, and in between we have some high energy state because of the solvent is not organized properly for the initial state. So we have to take into account this solvent reorganization. Now, in this diagram, the y-axis is free energy. So because free energy involves all kinds of coordinate solvents and molecule and so molecule coordinates and all the motions. So this is basically thermodynamic energy, free energy. And we need to go over some energy barrier, free energy barrier, in order to get this electron transfer reaction happening. Now, the valid theory of electron transfer is so-called Marcus theory, based on Rudy Marcus, who formulated the theory and got the Nobel Prize for it. And there are a couple of important principles in it. First one is that electron transfer occurs much faster than the nuclei move. And this is very similar with the Frank-Condon principle. Okay? Now, then the second one is the initial state and the final state have different charge distributions, and consequently the solvent accepts a different equilibrium configuration around them. So solvent has to move a lot in this electron transfer reaction. And now that means that this we can describe this as a thermal reaction where we have activation energy. And that activation energy is determined by the crossing point between the initial and final state potential surfaces. And the reaction rate can be calculated from an Arrhenius type of expression if we just know the activation energy. So the problem is to find the activation energy for this electron transfer reaction, and then we can calculate the rate. Okay, so this is how this is described. So this is a parabola. This parabola describes the free energy profile or the free energy surface of the initial state, where we have the donor and acceptor, and L describes here the basically the solvent molecules. Now, the final state is also described with similar energy parabola, free energy parabola. And the final state is now the D plus A minus. So electron has transferred from donor to acceptor. And on the left side, the minimum is the thermodynamic equilibrium for the initial state. So mostly the system is here. And the same thing for the final state. So final state equilibrium is here. So it means that after the electron transfer has occurred, everything rearranges so that we get here at the equilibrium. And now you can see that this is exothermic reaction. So we start from here, we end up here, and this is low in energy. So this is difference between these two minima is equal to basically Gibbs free energy of the reaction, so delta G. Okay, so we see that this actually likes to occur spontaneously, but there is an energy barrier, which is defined simply as a crossing point, which would be here. And now the picture is a little bit more complicated, so a little bit more advanced treatment actually makes this kind of smooth transition, not just a crossing point, but this would be equal to energy, activation energy, which is delta G hashtag. And one more parameter is so-called lambda here, which is a so-called reorganization energy. And that reorganization energy is a difference of the final state minimum, or basically equilibrium energy, and the final state energy at initial state equilibrium. And we can see that we can have a thermally activated reaction over the barrier, but we can also initiate this, could initiate this reaction by photoexcitation here, basically starting from here, and then it goes over all the way to the minimum. Okay, and now a couple of equations. So for this system, this is Arrhenius' expression for the rate. So I don't know if you're familiar with Arrhenius' expression, but it is a expression for rate of chemical reaction which is activated, which has activation energy. It is simply exponential description where we have some kind of factor A, and then exponent, and here we have the activation energy delta G upstairs and then KBT downstairs. This is fairly simple. And now if we know the delta G hashtag, we can calculate this, and if we also know the A parameter. Now A parameter is a little bit more tricky to know. We need some kind of better calculation for that, but we can also inspect just the relative rates at different situations. And let's see how it goes. Now, what is important in this Marcus model is that you can actually get this activation energy from the Marcus model from a couple of parameters. So this equation here is actually, you can calculate it from just two parabolas and finding their crossing point. So if you make this kind of model, just put two parabolas and find their crossing point, and you will find out that actually is given by this expression. So in this expression, you only have two parameters. One is delta G zero, which is the exothermicity. So it's a reaction, Gibbs free energy of the reaction. This is something you can determine. And then lambda is the reorganization energy. So if you know these two parameters, you can calculate the activation energy. Now, for the activation energy, it is, as I said, the free energy change between the final state at the equilibrium and the final state at the equilibrium configuration of the initial state. Now, if the delta G zero is zero, so that means exothermicity is zero, then actually this lambda corresponds to vertical energy difference between the initial and final states at the initial state equilibrium configuration. Let me go back here. So if this would be zero, delta G would be zero, then lambda would be equal to this vertical energy. And that is something we can measure from the spectra. If you see this transition, you can actually determine the lambda from there. Okay. So then just from the spectroscopy, you can determine the lambda. And if you know that delta G is zero, then you can determine the activation energy for the reaction. Otherwise, in general, the optical transition energy is equal to lambda plus delta G zero. So if you also, you can also measure the delta G separately, then you can determine the both optical transition and delta G, and then you can determine the lambda again. So there is a way to actually measure and determine the lambda. Now, what is important here is that this model gives a certain predictions about the behavior of the rate in terms of exothermicity. So how large is the exothermicity? And the first region, which is so-called normal region, occurs when delta G0 is negative, so it's exothermic reaction, but the exothermicity is smaller or equal to rearrangement energy. So it is not larger than rearrangement energy or minus of the rearrangement energy. And in this situation, when activation energy decreases, basically when the exothermicity increases, the activation energy decreases. And that you can see from this picture. So if I bring this down, this final state parabola, that means that the exothermicity increases. That means that crossing point comes down, 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 down. So that means that the activation energy decreases, and then because when activation energy increases, the rate of electron transfer increases. Okay, so and this is somehow intuitive. The larger the exothermicity, the faster the rate. Okay, that is intuitive. But then comes kind of a strange or interesting region, which is so-called inverted region. And that happens when the exothermicity becomes larger than rearrangement energy. And that what happens is that then actually the activation energy starts to increase again and reaction rate lowers. And this is explained here. So if I here are drawn the two parabolas and at different exothermicity situations. So starting from the left, delta G zero is zero. So exothermicity is zero. There is a barrier. Then we start increasing the exothermicity. So the crossing point goes down, the barrier goes down, and the rate goes up. Okay. Then we come to the critical point where the exothermicity is as large as lambda. And then the crossing point is exactly at the bottom of the initial state, and there is no barrier. So this the rate is as fast as it can be. There is no barrier. But when the exothermicity increases again, you see that then actually the crossing point goes to the left, and again the barrier increases. And then the reaction rate starts going down. And that means that there is only a certain range of exothermicities where the electron transfer rate is increasing and reaches its maximum. And if the exothermicity increases more, the reaction rate starts to become slower again. And this is something very interesting, and it has been verified experimentally by a series of experiments shown here. So here is many experiments with different molecules, different acceptor and donors, maybe different solvents, and the y-axis is a rate constant, measured rate constant, and the x-axis is exothermicity in terms of electron volts. And as you can see, you start from zero exothermicity, the rate is about 10 to 10, then exothermicity increases, the rate increases, and finally, at about 1 electron volt exothermicity, you come to maximum of about 5 times 10 to 11 for the rate, and then you start decreasing the rate again, going even below 10 to 10. So that is very interesting because it tells you that you can perform some kind of engineering or tailoring of electron transfer reactions depending on what is needed. And sometimes, for example, for solar cell applications, for example, you want to optimize your system so that forward electron transfer is has its maximum rate, basically, that the photo-induced electron transfer between acceptor and donor is at maximum, but at the same time you want to minimize the back electron transfer, and then in this you can engineer the molecules so that you can maybe get your back electron transfer to this region, to inverted region, but your forward electron transfer to the normal region, and then you can optimize this. Okay, so we stop here. But now you have heard the main basic theory of electron transfer reactions and the Marcus theory, which is really the theory of electron transfer. And you have a basic understanding of important factors, the ionization, solvation, oxidation, reduction of electron transfer. And you understand why excited state is a better reducing and oxidizing agent than the ground state. Okay, so that's all for this time. Thank you.